You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In the small city of Binghamton in upstate New York, 23-year-old Veronica Taft, a single mother with four small children, all under the age of five, was convicted of murder and manslaughter for the brutal murder of her two-year-old son, Lyric. She was sentenced to 25 years to life in state prison, with her surviving children taken away and placed in foster care. After more than 5 years in prison, Taft was set free after a bombshell appellate court decision found the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. The court overturned the theory and evidence used by authorities, including time of death, Taft's alibi, and controversial testimony of a desperate jailhouse snitch. Working on behalf of Taft, defense investigator David M. Beers conducted an independent investigation. In his account, Immunity for Murder, he'll guide you through the ill-fated police investigation and the shameful prosecution that, contrary to the evidence, quickly turned the tides towards Veronica and away from the real killer. This book will closely look at the suspect, bizarre events, and disturbing facts never before revealed. Furthermore, it'll show how the evidence proves Taft's innocence, which is why he considers her story a tragic miscarriage of justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is Immunity for Murder, The Veronica Taft Story, with my special guest, author and private investigator, David M. Beers. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, David M. Beers.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It was quite a story, and I was anxious to write it and to talk about it.
Yes. Let's take us right back to December 30th, 2010, and Binghamton, and population 45,000. You say it's the county seat for Broome County, New York, which is about 200,000. Tell us about Veronica, Ron, Lynn Taft, oldest of four girls. Tell us a little bit about her background, parents and siblings. Tell us a little bit about her life and background.
Yeah, well, Veronica, when this happened, she was like 23 years old, but she was... She was born and raised in a little town called Whitney Point, New York. She was the oldest of four. She had a younger sister and two younger brothers. And she was brought up in a kind of a middle-class home, a comfortable little home up in Whitney Point, New York, went to Whitney Point schools. But when she was in school, she was often, she was a very small girl. She was often bullied and teased and ridiculed by students and school officials. And by the time she was in about the seventh grade, she was diagnosed with ADD and ADHD. It never became serious enough to require medication, but it did affect her ability to learn in the mainstream. And so she got reassigned. She got classified as learning disabled. And they put her in what they call an alternative learning center. But surprisingly, once she went there, she really found her niche and her interest in learning excelled, and she became an honor roll student, and she did exceptionally well. Later, when she got out of school, I should back up a little bit. When she was in school, even though she was in this alternative learning center, she was still affiliated with the same school district, so she was able to participate in their extracurricular activities. So she became a varsity cheerleader, and because of her athletic ability and her small stature, she became the team's flyer. So she was pretty talented. But after high school, she kind of spread her wings and moved down into a little small village just west of Binghamton called Johnson City. And she met a man, and she entered into a relationship with him, and they had two children together, two girls, named Haveen and Amira. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that relationship was kind of short-lived when she became the victim of some domestic violence by the father. And so she severed her relationship with him. And then she entered into a new relationship with another man. And they had two more children, a little boy named Lyric and a little girl named Zoe. So now she had four small children in as many years, all under the age of five. And unfortunately, the second relationship deteriorated as well, with more incidents of domestic violence. And for a short period of time, she lost her children. You know, Child Protective Services took them away. But she severed her relationship with that man and actually moved out of state for a while. And eventually, things eased up with Child Protective Services. They gave her kids back, and she moved back to Binghamton. And she found a small little apartment on Fayette Street in the city of Binghamton, and a job working nights at the local high school doing maintenance work. And she worked the late shift, you know, from 11 p.m. till 7 a.m. And fast-forwarding just a little bit to this went on for about 6 or 8 weeks. Shortly after she moved back to Binghamton, she met a man by the name of Charles Pratt, which is commonly known as Chucky.
Right.
And they got together, and not long after that, their relationship turned intimate. And they weren't living together, but they were seeing each other regularly. And he seemed to have a good relationship with her children. So she felt comfortable asking him to babysit while she was at work. So that went on for about 6 or 8 weeks. But unfortunately, on December 30th, tragedy struck. And her 2-year-old son, Lyric, was discovered in the morning on December 30th, 2010, to be severely beaten. And he was taken to the hospital and pronounced dead.
Let's talk about Chucky Charles Pratt, as you do. He's 27
yeah.
years old at that time.
Yeah.
Tell us just a little bit about the information, especially his recent release from prison. In January.
Yeah, he was he'd been convicted of a drug charge down in New York City in the Bronx area, possession of controlled substance, and he was sentenced to state prison. He went to state prison. He was sentenced for 2 to 6 years. He went to state prison and actually got released on parole early, but he violated his parole, and they sent him back to prison to serve out his remaining sentence. He was eventually released, I think, in early 2010, and he ended up moving up to Binghamton for whatever reason, and he found a little apartment not far from where Veronica Taft was living, and then she got introduced to him through a friend. But he'd assured her that his drug dealing days were over, but when in fact they were not. He was still actively involved in buying, selling, and using drugs. So that's kind of Chucky's history in a nutshell.
Let's talk about December 30th. You talked about the conditions that he was the overnight babysitter. She had somebody else, Raymond Ramos, Rodriguez, I believe. But anyway, somebody else that was taking care of the children if she needed someone to during the day. But he was the overnight babysitter. They had been going out for a little while. They were intimate. And she went to work as customary, she would call him in during the night. Just tell us what happened during the night. She was at work. What was the phone call? There was a couple phone calls. What happens with this 911 call? Tell us the events that happen from earlier in the evening, previous, before she's getting ready to work. Give us some of the circumstances that led to this, and then tell us about the 911 call.
Yeah, sure. So back on the day before, on December 29th, she had a daytime babysitter there from like noon until about 5 o'clock, you know, watching the four kids. And during that time, he had fed the kids their lunch, and then later, just before he left, around 5 o'clock, he'd fed them, again, just peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And then, so Veronica comes home, and she's there with the kids. And she's there until she goes to work. And then she has to be to work at 11, so one of her coworkers picks her up and drives her there. But just before she goes to work, Chucky comes over to babysit for the night. So he came over about 10:15 or 10:30, and his stepbrother, Jamel, was with him. And so when he gets there, you know, Veronica's getting ready for work. Her son, Lyric, you know, before Chucky got there, her son had been in the bedroom with his sisters watching a movie. They were all ready for bed. But it was normal for them to stay up late to kind of stay on their mom's schedule. Mm-hmm. And so before Chucky gets there, Lyric wandered into his mom's room while she was getting ready for work, and he needed his diaper changed. So she did that. Then he wandered back to the bedroom. And then Chucky shows up, and her ride gets there about 10:45. So she pops her head into the kids' room, says a quick goodbye, and off she goes. But before leaving, she reminded Chucky to feed the kids. You know, she'd kind of preheated the oven for some French fries and some tater tots, maybe some and some mac and cheese, I believe. And in fact, she had preheated the oven to do that, and then she. But her ride got there, so she had to take off. So she goes to work, gets to work on time, and about 11:20 or so, she calls Chucky on his cell phone from work, from her work phone, and to make sure that he'd fed the kids and they were all fine, and he said they were, and they'd all eaten. So she continues working, and he stays there babysitting and puts the kids to bed. Then around 12:30, 1 o'clock, she calls back, and he assures her that the kids are all fine. And but the reason she was calling back is she was considering coming back home to pick up a movie, and if there was time to watch the movie at work with her coworkers, she would do that. But as it turned out, they were too busy. They had a lot of work to do, so she never did that. So she continues on working the rest of the night while Chucky's there with the kids. She gets off work at 7 o'clock, and her coworker that usually drives her home had another commitment, so he couldn't take her home, so she had to walk. And it's about a 15-minute walk. So she did that, gets home about 7:15. Chucky meets her at the door. And ordinarily she would go and check on her kids, but he assured her that kids were fine and she should just, you know, she was real tired. He says, "Yeah, just, you need to rest, you know, go down and get some sleep." So she just kind of did that. She went into her room and got undressed, got in bed. And then he joined her, and they fell asleep. And then around 10:30, they're waking up, and she hears the girls in the other room, and she's asking him, you know, why haven't you gone in to get him up, you know, get breakfast around? So he gets up, goes in, and he comes back and tells her that Lyric is blue and he's not breathing and he's cold. And she just kind of starts flipping out. What do you mean, you know? And so he runs back and picks up Lyric, brings him to her, and he's purple-colored and not breathing. She's in a panic, you know, slapping him on the back, trying to wake him up. And she says to him, you know, call 911, and he picks up the phone to do that. She just snatches it away and makes the call herself. It's hysterical. He can hardly understand what she's saying. Mm-hmm. And then she runs out into the street, down the stairs and out into the street yelling, you know, call the police. Does anybody know CPR? You know, she just in a panic and hysteria. And a neighbor runs across the street runs up the stairs with her, and together they start doing CPR, waiting for the ambulance to get there. And the ambulance finally gets there. The EMTs come up and they take over the life-saving efforts. And it was a pretty dire situation. So the lead EMT just grabbed him into his arms, rushed him downstairs into the ambulance, and off they went. And Veronica jumped in the ambulance with them, and they're off to
what
the
happens,
hospital.
David, what happens before this? There's a situation where, of course, she runs out into the street asking for CPR. You mentioned that neighbor comes and he is asked who he is, and he just pushes Chucky aside and goes and performs the CPR. But there is a point when Chucky becomes enraged, and what does he do, and what does she witness?
Yeah, exactly. So when the neighbor shows up there, you know, when he gets to the top of the stairs, Chucky's right there. He's asking who he is. So the neighbor said, "Yeah, I just pushed him out of the way and went to to try to do what I could for Lyric." And Veronica was right there, and somebody, I believe the neighbor's wife was right there too, and she overhears Veronica say something to Chucky like, you know, get out of my way. You know, and but then right around that same time, Veronica witnesses Chucky punch the wall of the living room right next to her bedroom wall with both fists, and it left a big gaping hole in the wall, pieces of plaster falling on the floor. And, you know, later he claimed that he did that because he was frustrated over what was happening to Lyric.
Right.
And then he, in that process, he had scraped off the skin off his knuckles, and his knuckles were bleeding. And that was noticed by the police when they brought him into the interrogation room a little bit later.
What do EMTs notice right away at arrival with the 2.5-year-old?
Yeah, one of the first things they noticed, of course, he wasn't breathing, but they also noticed that his abdomen was bloated, really puffed out. And interestingly, the Lyric was, rather than being in pajamas, he was in street clothes. He was wearing these little blue jeans and a hooded sweatshirt on top of a red long sleeve T-shirt, but the EMTs had noticed the bloating of the abdomen, how tight it was. So they removed his blue jeans to ease the pressure, just left them there on the floor, and then took over the life saving efforts on him. And like I explained, they went down to the ambulance. But they'd also noticed that he had marks all over his face and his neck and his head. And so that was obviously a concern. And they also noticed that the woman there, Veronica, was on her knees weeping hysterically.
Mm-hmm. Also, you talked about just the what they noticed in terms of rigor mortis, and you explain the extent of rigor mortis that would be expected around this time. So can you explain a little bit about rigor mortis and what those EMTs noticed and noted?
Yeah. Actually, the EMTs really hadn't noticed the rigor mortis. That was the doctors at the hospital, once they got there, started to notice the early onset of rigor mortis. And like I explained in the book, you know, rigor mortis usually starts to appear within about two to four hours after death, and then becomes maximal within 6 to 12 hours. By the time Lyric got to the hospital, it was around 11:15 a.m. And one of the first things they did, they removed his clothing and replaced them with warm compacts and blankets, and they pumped a warm saline solution into his stomach. But they also took his temperature, a rectal temperature, and his temperature had plunged like 12.5 degrees. So it was critically low. It was about 86 degrees Fahrenheit. So he was cold. But the EMTs had noticed when they were there that his extremities were cold, but his core seemed to be warm.
Right.
So all of those things were noted. But during his treatment at the emergency room, he was treated by ER doctors for the better part of an hour before he was pronounced dead. But during that time, in that 11:30 to 11:50 time frame, they'd noticed the early onset of rigor mortis in his extremities and in his jaw, and that was documented in the records. So it was kind of a clear indication that his death had occurred not long, not that long ago. So that was kind of an important part in determining, the time of death.
Mm-hmm. So to determine the time of death, of course, there needs to be an autopsy, but you write that what's interesting and maybe not so typical is that this woman has just been informed about her son. She doesn't even know the status as of yet in terms of that 1 hour, but you say within 30 minutes of being at that hospital, she's taken to Binghamton Police Department for an interview, isn't she?
Yeah. She'd just been told that her son was dead. She was praying that he was still alive because they were taking so much time working on him. But then she was finally notified that he was dead, and less than 30 minutes later, she's sitting in an interrogation room waiting to be interviewed.
Let's talk about also Chucky and his interview with the police. But tell us, unlike Veronica, does he not go to the hospital? Tell us about this, the circumstances in which he is still at the apartment when she isn't.
Yeah. So when it first happened, shortly after the EMTs arrived, the Binghamton police officers started arriving as well. And so Veronica was in the ambulance with her son, and her right after she left, her mother shows up because she had called her mother telling her that something was wrong with Lyric and to get right over there. So her mother, who worked at another hospital nearby, rushed over there. But by the time she got there, Veronica was gone. But Chucky was standing there on the street when she got there, so they spoke briefly. But then shortly after that, the police took Chucky directly to the police station. So he was at the police station about an hour before Veronica arrived, after learning about the death of her son. So he was already placed in an interview room, and police were scrambling, trying to make sense of everything. And so he was waiting to be interviewed. And for whatever reason, they let him have his cell phone in the interrogation room, which is kind of a – not kind of. It's a violation of their rules.
Right.
But so while he's in there waiting to be interviewed, he's on the phone with his stepbrother and his friend Max, and he's telling them all kinds of stuff. And he's just kind of going nuts. You know, he lawyers up right away. He's practically bouncing off the walls. And in my opinion, he was on drugs and very impatient. The police couldn't work fast enough for him. And like I said, he lawyered up real quick. In fact, he was seeking an attorney while he was still at the scene over at Fayette Street. He called his stepbrother and asked him to find a number of an attorney he could call. And then by the time he gets to the police station, you know, his brother finally calls him back. So he answers and gets the information, and he tries to call an attorney, and there's no answer, and he's trying to find another one. So he quickly let the police know that he wanted an attorney, so they were kind of limited as to what they could do as far as an interview with him.
Now, meanwhile, same circumstances, not the same circumstances, but you have Veronica being able to be cooperative with police and willing to answer questions, and didn't ask for an attorney. So in that regard, how does her interview go? What is the tone of that interview? And interestingly, you write about that when the investigators leave the room, she does speak out loud. What is sort of the general tone and some of the content of what she speaks out loud when they're gone?
Yeah, that was pretty revealing of how traumatized she was upon learning of the death of her son. The police officers were actually treating her pretty well, but there certainly wasn't much compassion to what she was going through. But anyway, they brought her into the room and told her they'd be with her in a little bit. And so, the camera's rolling, and you can hear her, you know, talking to herself out loud. You know, what happened to my baby? I love my baby. Just on and on. You know, God, take care of my baby. It just went on and on and on. You know, and she was kind of rocking back and forth unconsciously. She probably doesn't even remember doing that. It was just kind of horrible to watch and listen to what she was saying, and I tried to portray that as best I could in the story, but it's not quite the same as watching it. But she just went on and on and on before they finally came back in and sat down and talked with her and went through the whole story of how she'd gone to work, and the whole story I just explained earlier about Chucky being there babysitting and when he came over and when she left. And she went through that whole scenario, trying to recall from the best of her memory, what had happened. And she was there for probably a good 4 hours before they, finally finished with her for that day. And then as soon as she walked out of the room, Child Protective Services was there. Obviously, they were called in because of the surviving children that needed to be cared for. And that's why they brought in her mom, Veronica's mom, in so that she could take custody of the children, at least temporarily.
Right.
That was kind of the gist of her first interview.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about that first interview, but they're anxious to talk to her again.
Yeah.
In regards to her boyfriend, Chucky, and his potential involvement, especially considering all of the information that they have so far, what are the questions regarding Chucky to her?
They're asking her questions about Chucky. You know, if she knew anything about his criminal history, and she did. What else?
Regarding his guilt.
Does
they mention anything regarding his potential guilt, and what does she say in terms of that potential?
Yeah, she said he hadn't mentioned anything to her yet, but she told the investigator right near the end of her interview that it was her intention to, once she got out of there, she was going to go back to him and see if she could learn something from him that she could bring back and share with them. She wasn't – initially, she didn't want to believe that Chucky had anything to do with this because he'd always treated her and the kids very well. So she was kind of in denial that anything could have happened. So she was kind of under the belief that it was some type of accident or something, but she didn't know what happened and was basically trying to defend Chucky initially because she didn't know how severe the beating was, at least not at that point. So she had told the investigators that she was going to, because he'd already been released before the end of her interview, so she said she was going to, connect with him and see what she could find out and let him know.
With the interview that they have, which is not very long, you talk about Anthony Dials and you talk about Sergeant Tom Eggleton conducting the interview and speaking to him.
Yeah.
What is some of the, again, not typical behavior that this Chucky exhibits when they're not in the room, very much like Veronica, but also what are his concerns and what are some of the allegations that he makes to these police officers?
he's kind of saying repeatedly, they're looking at me like I'm a suspect, like I'm the frickin' killer. He's telling everybody he's talking to that, including Veronica. He finally got a hold of Veronica at the hospital, and he's telling her the same thing. Yeah, they're looking at me like a suspect. I'm the killer. I'm about to be arrested, I've never been through this stuff before. Just all kinds of bizarre things that, and he's saying some of these things even before it's been announced that Lyric is dead.
Yeah. What about he knows, they know about the wall, the hole in the wall. So they ask him about the wall and the bleeding knuckles. What does he have to say? And they are aware of some of these other things that were seen at that by doctors at the hospital. Do they question him about those specific things? And what's the follow-up to those questions?
Yeah, one of the things they were asking him about, of course, they asked him, if he knew what had happened. He says no, and he denied ever seeing Lyric that night at all. He said he did feed the kids, and he said he cleaned up 4 empty plates, but he said he never saw Lyric. Oh, I'm trying to think of everything else he said. Let's see. drawing a blank here.
Well, he talked about, his testimony was a little bit different in the interview when he talked about the order of some things about the feeding. He had mentioned that he had fed them late night. Veronica had forgotten that detail.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
as you write in the book, there's a lot of details that, as you say, she certainly suffered from trauma. So some of minor details were inconsistent, and it was discrepancies. When they spoke to him, they also asked him things like, would you have changed the diaper? Because, again, they had some information about that diaper. Now, So tell us what his responses are to the crucial questions of, in terms of, did he feed them? Did he see them? Who changed the diaper last? Would he change a diaper? Those are the kinds of things that they were speaking to him about, and it looked like they were putting him in a corner regarding those comments.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they did ask him, you know, who would change a diaper? You know, would you ever change the diaper? And or who would change diapers? And he said, oh, me once in a while, but usually it was Veronica or her oldest daughter, Haveen. And as far as feeding the kids, yeah, he did say that he fed all of the kids after she left for work. And he said when he came out of the game room after they were done eating, there was four empty plates there, and he said he was cleaning up in the kitchen, but he denied ever seeing Lyric or seeing him eating at the table with his sisters, which didn't make a lot of sense. But the other thing they questioned him about was the when they saw his bloody knuckles. That was right near the end of his interview. In fact, he had asked for a cigarette, and the Sergeant Eggleston said, yeah, I'll see what I can do. So he comes back later, and he's handing him his cigarette. So Chucky reaches up for it, and that's when Sergeant Eggleston saw the injuries on his knuckles, and he says to him, oh, what happened there? So he told him, he says, I punched the wall. I was frustrated about what happened to Lyric. And then he holds up his other hand and shows him the same thing. Yeah, oh, and this one too. So the knuckles on both hands were bloody, and he said that he was doing it out of frustration for what had happened to Lyric, and that supported what Veronica had told him, that she had seen him punch the wall a couple times with each fist. But the bizarre thing, they'd also known from one of their investigators who was at the hospital taking pictures of Lyric's injuries, that he had these gouge marks in his neck that were crescent shaped and appeared to be made by fingernails.
Right.
And you know, the bizarre thing for myself, you know, being a former crime scene investigator. You know, they didn't take any pictures, they didn't take any DNA, didn't take any fingernail scrapings.
Yes.
And I just felt that was pretty irresponsible.
You talk about the evidence that the police gathered and put into evidence. We talked about the pants that they had to take off at emergency because his stomach was distended.
Yeah.
But there was different evidence, or there was evidence in by the Birmingham Police Department with a diaper. What was it about that diaper that should have been examined, should have been tested, and wasn't?
Yeah, that was a big thing. Like I said earlier, when Lyric went to the hospital, he was wearing his pants had been removed, so he was just wearing that diaper and that hoodie with a light red shirt underneath. So each of those items were secured by an officer who was there, and they were each placed into separate evidence bags and tagged accordingly, so everything was done properly. And they were brought back to the station, put in the evidence locker. But it wasn't until January 7th, now we're talking about a week later, that another evidence technician takes those items out of the evidence locker to examine them. And she, you know, she takes them out one by one and takes pictures of them and looks them over. She didn't do anything much with the sweatshirt or the T-shirt. But the diaper was kind of a different story. It was a disposable diaper. And as she's looking at it, what really jumped out was the fact that there was five specks of blood on the outside of the diaper, not the inside, the outside. And she carefully photographed the diaper, and she even took these little red sticky arrows in to help point to where what she was showing, and some close-ups. And one of those spots was a rather large spot which looked like it was right on one of the closing tabs of the diaper that looked just like a bloody thumbprint. And that jumped out at me right away when I saw that. And so when I first saw that, I said, okay, you know, where's the lab results? You know, where's the DNA? But there wasn't any. They never tested it. And that just kind of blew me away. I said, how can you not do that? You know, Veronica was in the interview room that morning. She wasn't bleeding. And Chucky was. And Lyric wouldn't have changed his own diaper. And it just kind of blew me away that it was never tested. And it got even worse, Dan. It was about 5 months later, well before she was arrested, the district attorney got a hold of the Binghamton police. He wanted to look at that diaper himself. Right. So he goes over there. They pull it out of evidence, and they show it to him. He looks it over for about 8 minutes, according to the log. And so when I found out they were doing that, I said, okay, yeah, now they didn't test it before, but he's going to have it tested. Well, he didn't either. He just put it back in the bag and back into evidence. And it just kind of blew me away. I said, how can you not do that?
Yeah. Let's talk about who they start speaking to. Well, they have to speak to. They should speak to the stepbrother, Jamel, and also anybody else that he called from custody. But
yeah.
They asked Jamel about the night before, because he's there before Veronica leaves for work with a friend. What does he say regarding the clothing that Lyric is wearing that night? What was he wearing?
When they interviewed Jamel, he had gone over there with Chucky that night. He didn't mention what Lyric was wearing that night, but he'd been there earlier in the day, like in the morning with Chucky, and they'd had breakfast or something, and he noticed that Lyric was and the other kids were all in their pajamas, and said Lyric was in was wearing these SpongeBob pajamas. But when he went over there that night with Chucky, he didn't mention what the kids were wearing. I mean, he saw the girls, but he kind of backed up his brother and saying he never saw Lyric. But he did say that his brother Chucky was in his sleep clothes.
Right.
So that's pretty much what Jamel had to say about his being there, you know, that he kind of backed up his brother, that he didn't see Lyric, but did see the other girls, and that Chucky was in his sleep clothes. He was tired. He changed into his sleep clothes and was talking about going to bed as soon as the kids were in bed.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this in terms of, with the autopsy with Dr. Terzian.
Mm-hmm.
He initially says, and from his calculations, he puts the time of death at 3 a.m. to 4 a.m. And, of course, Veronica's at work, and they checked that out to make sure she didn't leave work whatsoever, and she didn't. Now they don't have a really good opportunity to question Chucky about anything regarding this, and they have a willing person that's willing to answer questions in three interviews.
Yeah.
So how does this person named Jesse Noel factor into this story?
Yeah, Jesse Noel, his name came up fairly early on during one of Veronica's interviews. She mentioned that she'd been in a brief relationship with this Jesse Noel, but the police never pursued that initially. It wasn't until June of 2011, six months into this, when Noel got arrested for domestic violence and contempt of court. He had a rather lengthy arrest history. He'd been arrested several times. due to a domestic violence incident in with the woman he was he had children with. And so in June he gets arrested again, and the police arrest him and they take him back to the station, and he sits down for an interview with one of the investigators, but they don't talk about what he's just been arrested for. They want to know what he can tell them about Veronica Taft.
Mm-hmm.
And so he proceeds to tell them that he was in a relationship with Veronica, and she told him what happened to Lyric, and that Chucky had been threatening her after this happened. And so he tells the police that after she learned about Chucky threatening Veronica, him and two of his friends went over to see Chucky with the intent of beating him up. But instead, when they got there, he confronted Chucky about what happened, wanted to know why he was beating up Veronica and you know, whatever happened to the little Lyric. And then he claims that Chucky, at that time, Chucky admitted to him that he had killed the little boy because he was frustrated. He was angry with Veronica because she was cheating on him and she was a crack smoking whore, and that's why he killed the baby and put him back in bed. So he tells the police that probably three or four times. So they lock him up. They lock up Jesse Noel. And then we fast forward about 2 weeks later. He's in the jail. The district attorney and three or four investigators go up to the jail. Jesse Noel's there with his attorney. And now the camera's rolling. And so they have him sign what they call a debriefing agreement. And he agrees to the conditions, and he signs it. And so then they said, okay, Jesse, tell us again what happened. I've already got a pretty good idea of what you're going to say, but tell us again. So he lays out the same story. And then all of a sudden, they start leaning on him and telling him they don't believe that he's being truthful, and none of his story makes any sense. And I would agree. But anyway, so Jesse Noel knew that, he was obviously looking for a deal for himself. But when they started confronting him with his lies, he knew that his deal was probably out the window. But then one of the investigators said, look, Jesse, we're willing to give you a clean slate here. And then one of the other investigators made the suggestion. Was it her that made the admission? Was it her that told you that? And of course, they'd already told them that Veronica was on the verge of being arrested anyway. So, right. So that was his cue to throw her under the bus. So he changes his story, he said, no, yeah, it was Veronica who admitted to killing her son. And then he describes the same scenario, only he puts Veronica in place of Chucky. And that's what they went with. They used his testimony at the trial later.
So tell us now, they have this new confession from this witness. They think they're prepared. You think it's outrageous what they are doing, given the information that they have. And you can't see any really honorable reason for doing this. It just seems practical. They need a prosecution. They need somebody to pin this on, and it seems to be Veronica. So tell us about DeLucia's prosecution and this arrest and trial.
Yeah, well, first it went to, first they arrested her, and then a week later they indicted her with a lengthy grand jury testimony. And then in August of 2012, she went on trial. And Peter DeLuccia was the senior assistant district attorney who prosecuted her. And he was the same one that I mentioned earlier about not examining the diaper. And so he calls in all of his witnesses, and probably one of the I don't know if I should use the word bizarre. I guess that's appropriate. You know, he calls in some of these witnesses who had no information at all about what happened to Lyric.
Right.
But they had provided information long before through Child Protective Services that Veronica was an unfit, abusive mother to all of her children. And they described numerous incidents, none of which were ever substantiated. And so DeLuccia very successfully portrayed Veronica as this monster, you know, then getting the jury to really hate her. And he was very successful at doing that. And then the first material witness was the doctor, Dr. Terzian. And, of course, he went on to describe Lyric's injuries and what he discovered during the autopsy. And then they put the pictures of Lyric's injuries, his little 30-pound body, up on the big screen. And it was pretty brutal, you know. And you could
right.
look at the eyes of the juror, and then they glance at the – they were appalled, obviously, and anybody would be. And then they glance over at Veronica, and of course I noticed those things, and from that point on it was over, and that was early in the trial. But from that point on, I think she was they weren't going to let her out of there.
How did they adjust? How did they try to explain the adjustment from 3 to 4 a.m. To the new theory that she had killed Lyric before she left for work? And maybe from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. and sometime in that area. How do they answer to that, or how do they explain that?
Well, they didn't explain it very well. But anyway, what they did was they got the doctor to testify that it was within the bounds of possibility, or within the realm of possibility, that it could have been there could have been a 50% error rate in the time of death, which would mean that Lyric was killed around 9 p.m. with dinner around 8 p.m. Because when he did the autopsy, they found some stomach contents that still remained in his stomach, and they were saved and frozen for further study. But then, you know, in the trial, obviously they have to find a way to push back the time of death. It was a huge hurdle for them, and they didn't do a very good job. And the doctor kept talking about compounding factors that could slow down the cooling rate of a body after it dies, after it's dead.
Right.
It just didn't make any sense that it would be that much different, especially when you're talking about a 2-year-old, when the formula he was using was based on that of an average adult, which is like 155 pounds. Lyric weighed 33 pounds, so if anything, the cooling rate would have been much faster, and on top of that, if you go back to 9 p.m. As the time of assault or the time of death, that would mean 13 hours or more between the time he was killed and the time he had his body temperature taken in the hospital the next morning. And if that's the case, you know, he would not have been in early rigor. He would have been in advanced, if not permanent, rigor.
Right. They also, the big contention is they ask her if she was the person that changed his diaper, Lyric's diaper, before she went to work, and she did. Now,
yeah.
Given that
yeah.
evidence of the blood evidence on and potential fingerprints on the outside of the diaper, and the doctor had testified that there was no external injuries.
Right.
Chucky tried to say that his knuckles were bloody from the wall, but that must have been happened after because Veronica witnessed that. So how do they deal with that at this trial?
Yeah, well, they described the bloody knuckles as a red herring.
Wow.
That's the words he used. They claimed that the bloody diaper had no evidentiary value. What was found on that diaper could have come from anyone in the household. It was pretty bizarre to listen to that that testimony coming from, you know, experts, you know, who's supposed to know what they're talking about, and it was really disturbing to listen to that, knowing it was false.
You talk about that the CPS Child Protection Service evidence, I put that in quotation marks, from these people that were malicious in their the content of their of the things that they said. There was no real evidence to back up anything, to corroborate any of these stories. But you said that was really some of the most damning evidence, again, that was brought in and likely influenced the jury. With the jury, they only deliberated about 4 hours. In your experience, what did you think might have happened with that short turnaround in terms of deliberation?
Well, we were obviously, we were pretty optimistic that it would be a not guilty verdict, you know, if they were paying attention at all. So we were really kind of blown away when they came back with a guilty verdict. It just didn't make any sense, you know, that. But like I said, you know, once they saw those pictures and she's the one sitting at the defense table, you know, I think it was all over.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, of course, she is devastated. David Butler is devastated. You are disappointed and frustrated. So what is the next step?
Well, the next step, obviously, is the first thing Dave Butler did was to file an intent to appeal, which he did. But, you know, that process is just the first step. Now it has to go to another attorney has to be assigned to write the appeal brief. And that's just a very lengthy process. It takes months, if not years. And it did. It took a real long time. Finally, an appellate appeal attorney was assigned, and he had to wait for all the transcripts to come in and then review everything and pick out the issues that needed to be addressed in the appeal. And so that took a long time. But I think he did a pretty good job with it.
Let's talk about those issues. But meanwhile, Veronica's in prison, labeled a baby killer.
Yeah.
What's her stay like? David Butler stays in contact. I think you do at some point. But tell us about just a little bit about what you know about her stay in prison.
Yeah, it was, you know, when I interviewed her for the book, you know, she talked for a while about life in prison. She said it was pretty brutal. You know, being called baby killer and compared to that Casey Anthony, who was accused of killing her young daughter, and just the behavior that's going on, you know, with the COs and other inmates, you know, urinating in the smoking and urinating in the showers, and, you know, cockroaches everywhere, and inmates, you know, women raping women, and you know, the CEOs treating you like crap. Just, you know, just on and on and on. So it had to be pretty brutal. So she shared some of that with them. It's probably worse than what she described, but I can't even imagine. It must have been horrible.
What about contact with her children? How difficult was that?
Yeah, very little. And I corresponded with her periodically. You know, just a maybe a Christmas card or a note to give her an update on the appeal process or something. But she'd always write right back. I got a few different letters from her, usually very lengthy ones, you know. And in one of them, she said that she did get a chance to talk to her kids, like, once a month. She said that, you know, they missed her crazy like she did them. And then later she asked me if I could dig out some of the pictures we had of her children in our case file. And so I did that and sent those to her and made her cry. So it had to be hard. And then another hard thing for her was, you know, while she was in prison, her grandma died, and she couldn't go to the funeral, and that she said that was probably one of the hardest things. She said she had a lot of problems trying to deal with that for a long time.
You say this appellate process takes a long time, and of course it does. And there were the issues that were most important, and you felt and that. For the most part, that you agreed with those. What were the issues that they brought forth in this appellate?
There were several issues. The main issue was that, and they agreed, was that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. And right. and they put that almost right in the very beginning of their decision. But then they went on to kind of explain why. And they really kind of attacked the prosecution and the police for the methods and the evidence they used, and they kind of tore apart the pathologist's testimony that he was offering opinions based on unsubstantiated information, and he was offering an opinion based on possibilities and right. assumptions. Rather than any direct evidence, so and then they tore apart the testimony of Jesse Noel and how he had admitted that telling the police three or four times that Chucky was the one who admitted this, and then they kind of really nailed it near the end when they said that moreover the paramour Chucky was granted immunity. To testify against Veronica. Wow.
And you call that a transactional immunity?
Correct.
A blanket immunity.
Yeah, a blanket immunity. It's just, unless you waive your immunity, it's granted automatically, at least in New York State. So any prosecution, that whoever gets immunity can never be charged with anything related to that testimony.
Is that immunity unique to New York State?
I don't think so. I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is it's pretty consistent everywhere. That there might be some exceptions, but to the best of my knowledge, it's. You know, once somebody's granted immunity, they can't be charged with any matter related to their testimony.
Right. Now you talk about the decision itself, the appellate decision. You say that basically said that this was a verdict was weighed against the evidence. So
yeah,
there is many options. Or a few options for the courts to proceed. What are a couple of the options that could have happened, and then tell us what does happen?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, they could they could choose to retry.
No, they can't. That was my original understanding when Dave Butler first called me and told me of the decision. I said to him, I said, you know, but that doesn't that mean we have to go back to trial? And he said, no. He says, it says right here, the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. It's over. So no, they threw it out. So that means they can't retry her.
Mm-hmm. And that's just not again, in your experience, that's not typical, is it?
No, it's not typical. I've had a number of murder cases that I've worked on for the defense that, for one reason or another, got reversed on appeal, but they came back for a retrial. But I've never in my career had one come back like this, where they just threw it out entirely.
You write, though, that Veronica isn't aware of everything that's going on. She's aware of something on her behalf, but at that time that this decision comes, you're not sure if she even knows. So what happens with her after this decision? Is she let out immediately? Just tell us the circumstances. They're fascinating.
No, when I first heard about it, it came in on December 1st of 2016. So that's how long she was in prison. So my first thought was, does Veronica know this? So we didn't know whether she'd learned about it or not. But we found out later that she did hear about it from a counselor there at the prison who had heard of the decision and informed Veronica. And of course, she was thinking like we were that it would mean another trial. But when she found out that no, it was the decision that was setting her free, she was pretty elated. And but she sat there in prison for another week almost before they finally let her go. But it was only due to the effort of a local family court attorney that heard about the decision and stepped up to kind of expedite that process. And so she was finally let out on the December 7th and got on the bus and came back home.
In terms of custody of her children, she didn't get her children back right away, but what was her efforts in terms to get them back? Was she successful?
Yeah, it was an uphill battle. She was back in family court several times. It took a year to get her two youngest girls back, and then 2 years to get her oldest daughter, Haveen, back. She was, she tells me, and I could have lost her forever. She was placed in a pre-adoption home, and it was on the verge of being adopted, and it was kind of just in the nick of time she was able to get her back, but it took 2 years, so she didn't get Haveen back until like February of 2020.
Wow, incredible.
So
now, on behalf of her, there was a law firm that filed a suit because she was in prison for 5.5 years, wrongful conviction. So that's underway. That legal.
Yeah, suit. That's pending. There have been some depositions taken. But the last I heard, they were in the process of getting ready to depose Dr. Terzian, and the state's attorney resigned, and then they were waiting for a new attorney to be assigned. So that's the last I'd heard on that.
Mm-hmm. So she has gained custody of her children. And you write that her life is not without difficulties, but she is back on her feet, a very strong woman. You
yeah.
write about the interviews with her mother, and you say that obviously she inherited a lot of the same type of characteristics
yeah.
from her mother, very strong-willed and determined,
yeah.
to say the least.
Yeah.
There is an incredible story that you write just at the end of this. On Fayette Street, the address of the apartment, people had moved into that apartment, and unbeknownst to them, this murder had happened in one of the rooms, and she had a 6-year-old child. Tell us about this incredible, otherworldly event.
Yeah, this was pretty unique, to say the least. I learned about this from another reporter. He actually worked for the New York Times. He'd been intrigued about the decision, the appellate court decision that threw out these charges against Veronica. So he contacted David Butler, the attorney, and wanted to meet with us to get some more details. So he came up, we met with him, and then he set out to conduct his own investigation. You know, Dave Butler just gave him his whole file because, you know, there wasn't going to be any retrial. So anyway, he sets out to do his own thing, and during the course of that, he went back to Fayette Street, and he goes into the same apartment where Veronica was living, and he met this woman and her husband and her six-year-old daughter, and they didn't know anything about the murder that had happened there, so they were it was news to them. Interestingly, the mother of the 6-year-old girl said that her daughter had a imaginary friend that would play in that same back bedroom where the murder took place. And they'd laugh and giggle and that type of thing. And she even wanted to buy gifts for him at Christmas time, that type of thing. And so the reporter asked him, says, what does she call him? And the mother didn't know, so she called to her daughter, and she came over, and she'd never heard the name before, so she had her spell it out on a little blackboard, and then the father, the little girl's father, read it off to the reporter and said the boy's name was Elric. So for what it's worth, Dan, I don't know. It's just I thought it was compelling enough to share in the story.
Absolutely. It's an incredible event. I want to thank you so much, David M. Beers, for coming on and talking about your latest Immunity for Murder, the Veronica Taft story. For those that might want to take a look at your work, do you have a website? Please tell us about that website or Facebook page for this.
Yeah, I have both. The website's very simple. It's davidmbeers.com. And the Facebook's name is the same, just, you know, David M. Beers. And I have two of them, one a personal one, and I have one for my books. So you should be able to find it on either one. You can also find it on Independent Author Network.
Right. Great. Thank you so much, David. This is incredible. You coming on and talking about this, Immunity for Murder, an incredible case, the Veronica Taft story. Thank you so much, David M. Beers. You have a great evening. Thank you so much for this interview.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks, Dan.
Good night.
All right, good night.